Going to do something a little different this morning. You all don't get the pulpit for me to hide behind. I will say that I have probably, at least in the last few months, never had as much comment about a sermon topic as I have had this morning before our assembly. If you will go ahead and open to the book of Romans, I'm probably going to be spending the next several times that I'm up here in the book of Romans doing a little bit of a survey. I was thinking back through my preaching history, and it was actually about 10 years ago that I preached a series on Romans at the congregation I was at the time. And this one's going to be a little bit shorter than that one. That one was like 16 lessons and was, and at this point, that would probably be a little over a year's worth of me preaching, so I'm not going to take that long. For as long as there have been pronouns, and that just occurred to me when I was standing back there, this is my second sermon in a row on pronouns and pronoun usage. For as long as there have been pronouns, there has been us and them. And when we think about the idea of us and them, we've always had two groups of people. There are the people who are like us and the people who aren't like us, the them. And if you go back through human history, that distinction has driven pretty much every conflict that the world has ever seen. Us and them. And there's a lot of different us's and them's, and it's present today. I think we all realize this. There's a lot of those that we could talk about this morning, and I may indirectly talk about several of them. There's one particular set of us and them I want to focus our attention on, and it's the us and them that we have in the book of Romans. And as we look at the first few chapters of the book of Romans, we begin, and Paul begins, as he often does, with this great statement about the gospel. I often say the first few verses of Romans are the gospel in a nutshell. Jesus Christ prophesied of the line of David, declared Son of God with power by the resurrection. For whom Paul was called as apostle. And Paul spends another few verses talking about his role in that as a preacher and some of his desire to see his brethren in Rome, who he has never seen face to face. And then there's actually evidence or a suggestion perhaps in the text that no apostle has been to Rome at this point. Probably the gospel got to Rome by way of the day of Pentecost, where though the Jews who were from Rome, who came to Jerusalem, some of them were among the 3,000 who heard and accepted Peter's message on the day of Pentecost, and they went back home and spread it. And that became, just as it did in the Judea area, a little bit of a source of conflict. The historical records suggest, and we know from the book of Acts, that Caesar had expelled the Jews from Rome, and the historical records suggest that it may have been because of some kind of controversy over the record says Christus or possibly Christ. And so that effort to spread the gospel there may have led to that expulsion that brought Aquila and Priscilla into Corinth. And so there's actually a little bit of debate when Paul writes this. While a lot of what Paul has to say, particularly in chapter 2, in chapters 9 and 10, and perhaps chapter 7, where he makes heavy reliance on the law and on Judaism and being a Jew, suggests that the Jewish population may have returned to Rome by that point. The things that say maybe maybe this was a primary Gentile group at this point, or groups. It's theorized that there may have been as many as 7 congregations in the Roman metropolitan area. But as Paul talks about his desire to come to Rome, he makes the statement that we very much remember, and that is a cornerstone of the letter to the Romans. He says, "I am not ashamed of the gospel." He had said, verse 15, he was eager to preach the gospel to those in Rome, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God to salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first, and also to the Greek. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, 'But the righteous shall live by faith.'" And so we have this great statement about the message of Jesus, that it is God's power to salvation. And as we get to verse 18, we start to hear about them. Paul talks about them because he says, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse." And as we go through the rest of chapter 1, I want you to put yourself, and really this doesn't require much effort, but put yourself in the mindset of these Christians in Rome who are hearing this letter, perhaps for the first time, thinking about all the ungodliness that is out there, all the stuff that they do, and everything they think about them. And like I said, this is probably not a hard mental exercise, because we look at the world today and we see all sorts of ungodliness and we see everything that they do. And there's a lot of things that we think about them that Paul seems to articulate here in these verses. The first one being, how can they so easily dismiss God? Because after all, as Paul says, it's so obvious. It's so obvious that God exists. And we talk about evidences, and sometimes we'll have a, well, duh moment. And yet, we say no matter how much we present this evidence that there's a God, there are people out there in the world who dismiss it. Or perhaps live as if there is no God, even if they may acknowledge the existence of a God. They have no intention of recognizing him. Like we talked about a couple weeks ago. It's evident. And yet they won't recognize it. But that's not all Paul says. For even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man and of birds and of four-footed animals and crawling creatures. Therefore, God gave them over to the lust of their hearts, to impurity, so that their bodies might be dishonored among them. For they exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. For this reason, God gave them over to degrading passions, for their women exchanged the natural function for that which is unnatural. And in the same way also, the men abandoned the natural function of the woman and burned in their desire towards one another, men with men committing indecent acts and receiving in their own persons the due penalty of their error. And we look at the world around us and we think, that, you know what, they have gone so far away from God's will. Read a couple verses further than I intended to, but because this point kind of bleeds into the next one a little bit. But we look at what's going on. Not only do we see where people just don't even want to acknowledge God, don't even want to recognize God? They have gone so far away from what all reasoning tells us is God's will. We see that and we marvel at it. And then we say they deserve what they get. The verse we just read said talked about the receiving in their bodies the due penalty of their error. Verse 28, and just as they did not see fit to acknowledge God any longer, God gave them over to a depraved mind to do those things which are not proper. Being filled with all unrighteousness, wickedness, greed, malice, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, malice, they are gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, arrogant, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, without understanding, untrustworthy, unloving, unmerciful. And although they know the ordinance of God, that those who practice such things are worthy of death, they not only do the same, but also give hearty approval to those who practice them. And we read what Paul has written here about the penalty for those who go so far against God's will. And sometimes we look at what they're doing and then look at what happens to them and say they get what they deserve. And it's easy for us to do this, for us to look at them and say that's what needs to happen. And what Paul writes is written from an inspired perspective, that is true. But I want to deal as much with the attitude behind our agreement with that as I do the factual truth of that. Because it's real easy for us to stand around and look at what they're doing and say, mm-hmm. They've just completely abandoned God and they get what they deserve. But, and I asked you a little bit ago to put yourself in the shoes of, or the sandals perhaps, of those in Rome in the first century. And imagine yourself when this was first read in their hearing. They wouldn't have had it in front of them to follow along with. It would just been the one guy, probably the person who delivered the message from, who delivered the letter from Paul, reading it in their hearing. And as the Roman brethren listened to that messenger read Paul's words of condemnation for all of those worldly people out there and all the bad that they do and all the things that they deserved, one can only imagine the hearty amens that were coming as this was read to them. Because after all, if we're Rome, we've chosen to come out of all of that. You know, Paul wrote in 1 Corinthians 6 describing certain sins, and he says, such were some of you, but what you were washed, you were sanctified, you were justified. You know, that's not us anymore. We're not like them. But also keep in mind, as this letter was first read in the hearing of the Roman brethren, that there were no chapter divisions. And so I'm going to go back to verse 32, and we're going to keep reading. And although they know the ordinance of God, that those who practice such things are worthy of death, they not only do the same, but give hearty approval to those who practice them. Therefore, you are without excuse. Every man of you who passes judgment, for in that you judge another, you condemn yourself, for you who judge practice the same thing. The shoe is on the other foot now. And Paul's no longer talking about them. He's talking about us and what we do. And the very first thing is that we do the same thing. Go back to that list at the end of chapter 1 and read through it and think about, can any of us say that we are guilty of none of the things in that list of things? That we have never been full of envy? Maybe none of us have committed murder, but have we never been filled with strife or deceit or malice? Have we never slandered anyone? Have we never been insolent or arrogant or boastful? Never been disobedient to parents? Now, I will go ahead and say that Paul is probably not talking about people under the age of 18 being disobedient to their parents. Though that is certainly an application that can be made. he is probably as much talking about adult children taking care of their parents and honoring their parents in their old, in their parents' older age. Has there never been a time when we've been untrustworthy or unloving or unmerciful? Can any of us really and truly and honestly say we have never done any of the things that Paul is condemning in this text? We focus, we usually when we talk about what they do, we focus on some of those bigger picture things that are earlier in the chapter. But these little nitty-gritty things that we see in verses 29 through 31 are as much a part of it as those bigger picture things. And guess what? We do the same things. And, verse 2, we know that the judgment of God rightly falls upon those who practice such things. And do you suppose this, O man, when you pass judgment upon those who practice such things and do the same yourself, that you will escape the judgment of God? Do we think we're going to be in any better situation before God's throne than them, than they will be, when we're doing the same things? And I guess pretend that we're not. Because the truth of the matter is that our knowledge of the right thing isn't going to be enough in the final analysis. You know, verse 2 already said, we know that the judgment of God rightly falls upon those who practice such things. You know, and all the things that we know, and this is where we start to get into some of the Jew and Gentile discussion, and where Paul deals heavily with the idea of being Jews and of knowing the law. The law was something that they were taught from their youth, and yet they were not doing it. We know the truth. But knowing the truth isn't going to be enough. Verse 12. For all who have sinned without the law will also perish without the law. All who have sinned under the law will be judged by the law. For not the hearers of the law are just before God, but the doers of the law will be justified. For when the Gentiles who do not have the law do instinctively the things of the law, these, not having the law, are a law to themselves, in that they show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience bearing witness, and their thoughts alternately accusing or else defending them. The key is not whether we know the right thing, but it's whether we do the right thing. But then there's one more thing. And when we talk about us versus them, and us not doing the right thing, or them not doing the right thing, there's something that Paul points out that really, in this whole analysis, we start off with thinking that, you know, they're really bad and they're really terrible and they've got a lot of stuff coming to them. But in some ways, it's worse for us. I'm going to skip down to verse 21. You therefore who teach another, do you not teach yourself? You who preach that one should not steal, do you steal? You who say that one should not commit adultery, do you commit adultery? You who abhor idols, do you rob temples? You who boast in the law, through your breaking the law, do you dishonor God? Verse 24, for the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you, just as it is written. The difference between what they do and what we do is that when we do the things that are contrary to God's will, because we have made associated ourselves with God. After all, we've taken on the name Christian. Because we've associated ourselves with God and we've staked our claim to following God. The things that we do that are contrary to God's will just became exhibit A in their case against God. And have just given the world an opportunity to speak evil against God. Those Christians who think they're so righteous and that God they serve. After all, we think back through all the tragedies of history that have been perpetuated or perpetrated, either one works, in the name of Christianity, in the name of serving the Lord. And we're still dealing with them. And the fallout from them. The thing about us and them, when we deal with this, is that we have to remember what our goal is. Our goal is not making a bright line distinction between those who are doing right and those who aren't. When Paul is preaching the gospel, he wasn't trying to figure out who was right and who was wrong and make permanent distinctions between those two groups of people. He was looking at everybody and trying to make all of them part of us. He was trying to get rid of them in the sense of there was no more them because they were all us. And it's just us left. Because he's converted them all. But we get trapped into this us and them mentality of we look at the world and yes, there is a lot going on in the world that is not what God wants to be going on. Absolutely. But when we look at what's going on out there, do we see something that is fixed and unalterable And so we might as well just cut our losses and get as far away from all of them as we can. Or do we see what we can do and make our efforts to persuade men? Because the thing is, there's a reality for everyone in all of this. When we get to chapter 3, chapter 1, or the second half of chapter 1, was they're wrong. They've sinned. They are deserving of God's wrath. Chapter 2 is so are we. Chapter 3 is summing it up as everybody has a problem. There is none who is righteous. No, not one. And we work our way down to verse 23. And Paul says, all of us have sinned and fall short of God's glory. All of us have made that mistake. All of us have failed to do what God has commanded us to do. So all of us have sinned. All of us fall short of God's glory. And ultimately, the next verse says that all of us need that redemption. That being redeemed is this gift that we have in Christ Jesus. That's what this is about. This is not about a tribal us versus them where the two never meet. It's about everyone being equally in need of redemption, of the grace of God, of God's mercy, of God's love, which is what we'll talk about next time I'm up here. But as we close, the question is, are not so much us and them, but me and you. What do I need to do? What do you need to do? Perhaps you've realized that you need this redemption to deal with all the sin problems that Paul lays out in the first two chapters and a half of this letter. Maybe you've realized that you need to submit to him in baptism so that those sins can be dealt with, so that you can have new life in Or maybe you've already done that and there's other things that you need to do to get back to this relationship with God that all of us should want. And if we can help you do that, let us know as we stand and as we sing.